Carlos Ayer's memoir Waiting for Snow in Havana won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2003. Now he's turned his attention to a very different subject, eternity. Ayer started to worry about death when he was a child, growing up in Cuba during an era of public executions, as he told Steve Paulson.
I grew up with a lot of violence, even before Fidel Castro took over, the few years before his ouster of Batista. Havana was a very violent place. Not only were the newspapers and magazines filled with pictures of people who had been gunned down in the street, but every night as I went to sleep, just about it seemed, maybe a few nights a week, we'd hear gunshots and bombs off in the distance. After Fidel Castro took over, the violence became of a different sort, mass killings, people being shot live on television. I watched all this. I had relatives who were executed. Once we survived an aerial bombing during the Bay of Pigs invasion. When my mother entered the room shouting, we're all going to die. Those are triggers I can remember that, you know, sort of set me thinking down the path about death.
I can see why. Well, I have to ask, do you still agonize about death?
I'm not sure I agonize over it. I puzzle over it constantly. It just seems so unfair to me. To be alive, whatever that means, to exist, and then suddenly not to exist, that bothers me. I can see getting rid of the body, especially as you get older and the body doesn't respond the way that you were used to it. But I'm always puzzled, really, really genuinely puzzled, and a couple of reviews of the book that have come out have puzzled me intensely. I can't see how anyone on earth could be happy with thinking that this is it. This is it. And a couple of reviews have actually said that, you know, in essence, the book takes up what is really a very bad idea, because we should all be very, very happy with our mortality and the briefness of our lives. And that I can't understand. Hmm.
That is interesting, because I know there are some people who just don't get too upset at the prospect of the nothingness out there, or the nothingness that might come after our lives end, whereas others, you apparently, mm-hmm. are deeply troubled by that.
Immensely. It's the ultimate unfairness and injustice, I think, to be conscious and to be aware of the fact that, there will come a day when you will cease to exist, at least in this form. Now, and also watching others disappear who are part of your life, whom you love, that's very hard to think that that's it, that you'll never see them again. Perhaps that puzzles me more, that anyone would be happy with that arrangement, than the thought of one's own existence coming to an end.
Well, it will take me back to ancient times when these ideas of eternity started getting worked out. I mean, Plato, the great Greek philosopher, was one of the first who had this idea of some eternal realm. What did he think?
Well, for Plato, our earthly existence is really a come down from our previous existence in eternity. He doesn't go into how this happened, but we human beings end up being trapped in our bodies here in the material world, which is an inferior state of existence. And in many ways, it's this Platonic conception, which in and of itself is based on earlier Greek thought. But it's this conception that becomes, in essence, the Christian idea of eternity, that this world, because it's in constant flux and there's pain and death and suffering, and, well, we all come to an end, is inferior to some other realm, higher, in which existence is eternal.
Well, it would seem that maybe the biggest difference between the Christian view of heaven and the earlier Greek view of the afterlife was this idea of salvation. I mean, basically, to get into heaven, only the worthy souls will make it.
Right. It's keyed to one's behavior in this life. One's eternal being is determined by how one behaves while one is alive on earth. So that puts a lot of weight on one's ethics. In the 18th century, when many Europeans started denying not just the existence of eternity, but of God altogether, those who did so, like Voltaire, for instance, wondered out loud whether people could be encouraged to behave as good citizens without some notion of eternal justice or of justice beyond this life.
Without the threat of damnation.
That's right. And in fact, we seem to have gotten along fairly well, although there are notable exceptions. Places that have gone totally awry, I think, precisely because of their materialistic focus. Places like Soviet Union, the Third Reich, and present-day China.
And let me just follow up on that, because that's a very provocative statement that you make, and you talk about it a bit in your book, that totalitarian regimes do not have a concept of eternity, of the afterlife, and you think they're worse off because of it.
Yes, definitely. I think it helps. The largest argument I make in the book is that the way we think makes an enormous difference on the way in which we live, that ideas actually have practical outcomes. Totalitarian regimes completely devalue the individual. And what we treasure so much here in the United States and in the West in general is the idea of not just individual integrity of every person, but individual rights. Totalitarian regimes have a way of wiping that out because, in essence, human society is not much different from an ant colony. And there's no point on the horizon beyond the present or the 5-year plan or the 10-year plan or, as in the case of the Third Reich, you know, a 1,000-year empire. But beyond that, there's nothing, and the individual really doesn't matter because doing away with one person is the same as sucking up a dust mite with your vacuum cleaner.
The other great strain of modern thinking is that many people have lost their faith, and the whole idea of the afterlife can seem slightly ridiculous. You call this the postmodern period. And I guess it raises the question, as the idea of eternity is slipping away, have we lost something valuable?
I think we have, but I think we've also gained some advantages over previous ages. We have proof of the fact that belief in the afterlife is a lot like nuclear energy. It can be used for good. It could be used for evil. You know, while I think a lack of belief in an afterlife did, in fact, help the Third Reich to become what it actually did become. On the other side, it's belief in an afterlife that led the 9/11 terrorists to crash their planes into buildings and to kill not just hundreds but thousands of people. And we keep seeing it week after week, suicide bombers in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel.
And you're saying take away that promise of the afterlife, that you will be rewarded in heaven, then, and those people are not going to commit those suicide acts.
I think it will be much harder to motivate people to do that, yes. There's a definite religious component to our present-day suicide bomber phenomenon, and that is the dark side of belief in an afterlife. One thing I've learned by studying religion for 35 years is that religion is no different from anything else that we humans live with, create, and employ. It's a lot like a knife. You know, you can use it to peel an apple. You can use it to cut somebody's throat. Religion, it's the same thing. A belief does not necessarily lead you to a single conclusion, but it does make, pardon the pun, a hell of a difference, whether you believe in hell or not, and heaven too. So my conclusion in the book, I really don't say whether we're better off or not, but I really do believe, and I do say this, that we have lost something. We have. We've gained a few things, perhaps a good number of things, but we've also lost what I think is most crucial for us as human beings, which is to value every life as something that is not just a little blip on a timeline, but as something that is, in essence, way above and beyond what it seems to be. Once a person dies, they're dead and gone. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes. You don't see them again materially. And if you lose that hope that there's something beyond that point, life becomes much smaller, much less significant, at least for me. But I think also for a culture and for civilizations in general, it's much easier to lose sight of the value of every individual when you think that all they are is a collection of cells and electrical impulses, and that's all there is.
Carlos Ayer is the author of A Very Brief History of Eternity. He spoke with Steve Paulson.